At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
Coming up on episode 355 of Wheel Bearings, we got the 2025 Ram 1500, the Porsche Cayenne GTS, the Buick Envista, the Lexus LFR, the Chevy 4.5-liter Duramax V8 that never made it to production. Fisker finally files for bankruptcy. Casey's engine goes boom. Rivian R1 updates on and more coming up next. This is episode 355 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual Samet from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin from CarBuzz.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And Nicole, what have you been driving?
I drove two things that couldn't be further apart in terms of performance. Do we want to start with low performance or high performance? Which one first, guys?
I'm looking at the rundown. Both look like, you know, four-door, you know, crossover.
Totally comparable vehicles. Okay, let's start with
the same.
The low power one. So I have the 2024 Buick Envista Avenir, which is the fancy trim. So the Envista is new this year. It's I'd say a compact crossover or compact SUV. Not super expensive in the grand scheme. So it's 28.6 in the Avenir trim, which is the most expensive one. Destination, guys, what do you think?
Oh,
1200.
Oh.
You can't both say 12. Okay. Sam said it first.
I said it first.
All right.
1400.
Sam wins. 1095.
Oh,
I should have got down.
Yeah, you just talked faster.
If you had gone 1199, you would have beat me.
You would have won. So 28.6 is the most expensive version of this that you can get. It's not a super expensive vehicle. And even though, you know, it's a Buick, which is like a more premium vehicle, the least expensive version of this you can get into for $23,495. So it's pretty cheap. And it doesn't look cheap on the outside. It doesn't look like a down market car or anything. It actually looks kind of slick. I think it looks very sporty. It's really cute. But on the inside, that's where you kind of feel it. I was in the Avenir, which is the top trim of this. And it has, there's a lot of plastics. You know, it has that sort of, that's where you think, okay, this isn't exactly the fanciest car that I've ever been in. It's not unattractive or like
$28,000.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's $28,000. So for a $28,000 car, you look at it and you think this is not bad. It was very comfortable. I found the seats very comfortable. It has, you know, three people in the back, two people in the back. You don't want to put three people back there.
Three, like let's say you're friends with models or toddlers.
Right. Models or toddlers. No, toddlers would be worse because they would like, don't touch me.
Plus you got to use the car seats.
And I feel like
those are actually wider.
Would be like, car seats. Like you'd have to spring them in. Like when I used to put three car seats in the back of some cars and we'd have friends when our kids were little, you just put the middle seat in first. And then you'd have to pull it all to one side to get the right-hand seat and sort of push it all to one side to get the left-hand seat and sort of like spring it together, like spring. Okay, now they're all wedged in there. Nothing's getting out. It was like an effort to get three car seats in a lot of little like small SUVs like this.
But a couple of, you know, three tweens you could fit in there.
You could fit three tweens in there as well. Tweens and models. That's all you can carry in the back.
Is a tween like 11?
It's like
11, 12.
Okay. I don't know. I kind of call like 13. I think you'd be a teenager, but you're those like early, really early teens and not
middle schoolers.
Middle school kids. That's what they are. Middle school kids. You're right.
Extras in the Wonder Years.
Extras in the Wonder Years.
There you go.
So this is front wheel drive only. That's one of the things that could be a deal breaker for a lot of people. If you want all wheel drive, can't have it. Get another car. And it has a 6-speed automatic with a 1.2-liter turbocharged 3-cylinder. Not a lot. 137 horsepower, 162 pound-feet of torque. Again, not a lot. And if you look at this just exclusively by the numbers, it seems like it's underpowered and horrible and it's going to be this miserable car to drive. Those are really small numbers. But surprisingly, it is a decent engine. You're not going to win a race in this. It's not something for people who want really strong performance, but it is more than adequate. Like, it does fine when you're accelerating up to highway speeds. It gets up there just fine. And it's not even super noisy doing it, which I feel like is a like saying something. Because a lot of times when you have an underpowered engine and you mash that gas, it sounds like the engine's just going to explode right up from underneath the hood. You're like, oh gosh, I've done too much. It's going to get
it's just yelling at you.
And you're like, this is
you bought the wrong car for this.
Exactly. This is not what I was designed for. But this one sort of says, well, this is not what I was designed for, but okay, fine. I'll deliver when you smash the gas to get on the highway. So I enjoyed driving this. I thought it was a nice little car. It's very comfortable. It's, like I said, quiet even when you're mashing the pedal, and it's just quiet on the road. I didn't find it very noisy. Not a lot of wind noise, not a lot of road noise. So it delivers that sort of comfort that I think is more of a priority than performance in a car like in a Buick. You want it to be comfortable. You want it to be quiet. I enjoyed driving this. The only thing I didn't enjoy, there was a giant spider in my car, like the giantest spider I've ever seen, to the point that I told Russ to smash it with a shoe. And I'm like, if you don't smash this spider with a shoe, I'm not getting back in this car. Biggest spider I've ever seen in New Hampshire. It was scary. I debated if it actually came with the car from wherever the car was before. I was like, you know those memes where they show like you couldn't find the spider, you burned down the house? I'm like, I wonder how Buick would feel if I just burned the car down. Because I can't drive it like this.
we're pretty pro spider here. So there's spiders everywhere around my house, like all the time, everywhere. Always well, picking
I've
them
never
up, taken them out.
A dinner invitation from you ever, unless yeah, that it, dinner is.
It's
out.
Like a giant cobweb. We're like the Addams family.
The spider was so big it was fuzzy. We don't have fuzzy spiders in New Hampshire.
It might have been someone's pet.
I don't think so. Like,
has anyone seen my spider? Oh my God, was it in that Buick? I'm like, I'm sure it'll be fine.
If your spider was in that Buick, then forget it, because your spider is now mashed all over the floor of that Buick. Although I made Russ clean up. I'm not even lying. I didn't clean up. I'm like, you get rid of the spider guts that are everywhere.
Maybe he didn't. Maybe he defriended it and set it free.
What's that? I should have said it.
Maybe he befriended it. No, maybe he befriended it and sent it to
me. No, because I didn't trust him like a good wife, and I made sure that I viewed the spider remains before he cleaned them out of the car to know he really got the spider, and it wasn't somehow still roaming around the car to surprise me later. It's dead. Oh. It was gone. But aside from the spider interaction that scared the bejesus out of me, I really enjoy driving this car. I think it's and I love the style of this, like that sort of slopey kind of sporty little front. It's a nice looking car. And Russ said to me when he saw it in the driveway, hey, we have a bear. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And I expected to see an actual bear. But he thinks the new Buick Tri-Shield logo looks like claws. Like someone, so it makes him think of a bear claw. So he calls it a bear. I'm like, that's probably the most aggressive name this Buick Envista will get from any person ever.
But I
yeah, so I like it. And, you know, it has a decent little amount of cargo room. It has, you know, good infotainment. I love that the storage for it, so especially in small vehicles like this, you have like cup holders sometimes and a spot that's maybe big enough for your key up front. So if you have anything else in your hands, your sunglasses, a wallet or whatever, even sometimes the center console won't hold it. Not only does the center console completely hold my wallet, I also could just shove it like in the little storage area. So I appreciate there's a surprising amount of little cubby storage in this for a car that's so small. So I am pro Envista. I really like it. I think it's a people are picking on it because it doesn't have a giant engine, but that's not why you buy this. It's not why you buy it. Don't buy this car if that's what your priority is. That's not your priority if you're buying this.
Not everyone's. I think a lot of automotive journalists it doesn't go very fast. I'm like, okay, first of all, most people aren't going don't need to go that fast. What are you doing?
How fast do you actually need to go?
That's if you're like road and track, yeah, totally. That's your jam. Yeah. But if you're like regular cars.com and you're angry because a car doesn't do 0 to 60 in another 5 seconds, you need to chill out.
And realistically, like how many, like we're a bunch of, you know, journalists, we're into cars. We look at things like 0 to 60 time and horsepower and the kind of engine and blah, blah, blah. Most people have no idea how fast their car actually goes. Like, do you think the average Joe knows what the 0 to 60 time is?
They just want to get on the freeway.
Exactly. Is it fast enough to merge with freeway traffic? The Envista absolutely is.
Exactly. That's what you need. You need to not feel like when you hit that gas pedal that you can't get the reaction you want to merge into traffic, or to, you know, if you have to do a quick maneuver because something's gone wrong, there's something in the road, I got to steer on. You need it to be able to do that. If it does that, then it has all the power and handling that you really need. That's what most people look at.
I mean, I was at Rivian a couple of days ago. They were doing a local briefing here at their tech center in Plymouth, Michigan, mm-hmm. On the updated R1. And also they showed us that we got to see the R2 and the R3 and the R3X. And, you know, they were talking about the powertrain updates. And I brought, why do we need a pickup truck or an SUV with 1,025 horsepower? Who needs this vehicle? Who needs this truck that can go 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds? This is ridiculous. The base two motor with 530 some horsepower, even, you know, with the standard LFP battery, still goes 0 to 60 in like 4.5 seconds. That is more than fast enough for anybody.
I wonder if it's like, you know, and I know that like the crazy horsepower on these EVs, but like, is everybody who's buying an EV, like, I get it. If you're listing horsepower numbers, you're super focused on making them stupid on something like a Mustang, because you're buying a Mustang because you want a sporty little car, right? Or like a Corvette or something. But are that many people buying an EV because of the performance? I don't know that they are. Like, you know, is it because it's green? Is it because it's the future? Is it because you just want an EV? Or is like, I want all the horsepower. I wonder how many that is like their priority. I'm buying an EV.
Those launch modes are they're essentially like parlor tricks. You do it once or twice on your own. You're like,
right? you show it off to a couple of friends.
You show it off to your friends.
And then you never use it again.
No.
Exactly. You never, ever use it again. First, I got to find the middle of nowhere every time I want to do it. If you're like a good person.
Yes, you're not just doing this.
You have to go out to the middle of nowhere. You have to convince your friends to sit in the car and do this thing. And some of my friends, when I've done it, they're like, don't do that again. They are not happy. Right?
Well, like, what's it? Watts to Freedom, the WTF, which is the cutest name of all of them on the Hummer. I appreciate that they came up with that. I can see engineers like, how can we say WTF but not have it mean what it means?
Watts to Freedom. Watts for America.
We got this. And it's super fun. Like, it's a fun thing, but it is a gimmick, and you have to be on a closed area, like an empty parking lot or something, where you know you can do it and you're not going to come across anybody. So, it's fun, but that's not your daily driving.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
Experience.
It's a lot of money for a goofy feature that, again, you're never going to use. And you're potentially going to put yourself and other people's lives in danger if you use it irresponsibly.
Yeah, if you're using it irresponsibly.
I've been on the freeway. I see how you people drive.
But, you know, going back to the Invista, you know, besides that engine, you know, the other nice thing about the powertrain, it's a 6-speed automatic. It's not a CVT.
Right?
Oh. So
it's actually a lot more pleasant to drive.
Which I think adds a lot, because, you know, the CVTs, especially when they're in sort of underpowered cars, they're not fun. And that probably is part of why it doesn't sound so loud, because you don't have an EVT that's just like screaming. You know, you have a 6-speed automatic transmission that's doing.
And 3-cylinder engines make a nice little growl. They have a nice little growl to them.
It sounds
that I really like.
Yeah. I really, the first time I drove this, I thought, this is really, I really like this. I remember commenting on it and people like, that stupid tiny little engine. I'm like, dude, have you driven it? No. Have you even, would you know?
It's not that heavy. It's only 3,000 pounds.
Exactly. It's small. It's not like they put this into something the size of a, you know, Ford Explorer or something. This is a small vehicle. So not having as much power as some of the big SUVs is okay, because this isn't that big. It's smaller. I think it's a great car for somebody who wants a little bit of, you know, a little bit of the versatility and sort of uprightness that you get in a crossover, but doesn't want to go with something really big, still wants it to be attractive. It looks good. It has nice features, and it stays in your budget without you looking like you went with a budget car really well. Yeah. I like how it does that. So
It doesn't look cheap.
No, it really doesn't. It doesn't look luxury. Like, the inside does not scream luxury. Like, some of the Avenir trims are fancier, you know what I mean? But this is an Avenir on a very base vehicle to begin with. It still looks good. So I was a fan of this. I like the Invista. I've liked it every time I've driven. I'm like, I like this little car.
Invista. Like, it has a little song for it now.
Song? Is that what we need? A little Invista song?
Just be sure to get one without the spider option.
Right. Don't get the spider option. I pass on the giant fuzzy spider.
Unless you are into spiders.
unless you're pro spider, like the Baldwin.
They
take care of all the other animals. It's a whole ecosystem, and then the birds and the hummingbirds.
They don't. In my car, they become mush.
I don't think we want them in our car.
They don't want
them. What are they going to? You're taking some. They don't know. Where am I?
They're not like in the car, and not in the bathroom at nighttime.
Yeah,
my wife is very pro spider in general. I mean, because they're great. Getting rid of other pest insects.
Yes,
but what she will not tolerate is spiders either in the bedroom or in the bathroom, particularly at night.
Yeah, the bedroom thing.
She doesn't want those kind of surprises.
You want a spider coming in your mouth,
right? Taking over your brain, running your life. There was one more spider story. One more spider story. It's a very spider-heavy podcast today. So yesterday, I'm in the bathroom washing my hands. I look over, and all three, two dogs and one cat are just staring at me. They just follow me everywhere I go. The other two cats will come when they feel like it, but two dogs and one cat always. And there's a spider. I'm like, oh, I got to get something so I can take this spider outside. And I go and I'm looking around, like, because I don't have a cup or anything in the bathroom. I'm looking around for something. And I turn around and the spider's gone. And all the animals were where the spider was. And now they're all dissipated. I'm like, well, one of them ate a spider.
We will never know, but we had a little snack.
The circle of life.
All right. So. And you had another car that was just like the Invista, right?
Exactly. You could hardly tell the difference. Power, everything totally the same. I had the 25 Porsche Cayenne GTS Coupe or Coupe.
So it's even a fastback SUV like the Invista.
It's hard to tell the difference. So the GTS, the Cayenne GTS has been a part of the lineup before, but when they redid the Cayenne, they sort of introduced the trims almost like in stages. So the GTS arrives for 2025. And they have it as a coupe or an SUV. We drove the coupe and we drove it around beautiful, twisting, crazy switchback roads near where they're based out of in Georgia.
Atlanta.
Thank you. I'm like, what is that? I'm like, what's the city?
Town,
where they are. Yeah, hot Atlanta. So this is so that when you get the Cayenne, there's a V6, there's a plug-in hybrid, there's a V8. In the V8s, this sits in the middle. So you have the Cayenne S, which has it, which is normal-ish in power, and then you have the Cayenne GT, which is bazonkers and also crazy expensive, and then you have the GTS, which sits in the middle. It's the just right temperature, she's picking out the different oatmeals and picking out the different beds. It's the just right oatmeal. It's exactly the perfect one if you want to have the performance, but you also don't want to have the crazy expense of going with something like a GT.
I don't think Porsche is going to appreciate you compare their car to oatmeal.
I don't know. Just right oatmeal. When you're trying to pick the just right.
Oatmeal or Buick? I mean, which would you rather be compared to?
Right. It's still a
Porsche. If Porsche made oatmeal, it'd probably be really good. And
it would really be really nice oatmeal. It would be perfectly sourced grains. And I really like this. So I don't drive Porsches very often. And the last time I drove the Cayenne was quite some time ago. So it wasn't just about for me getting into the GTS trim of this. It was getting some time with the Cayenne, period, the end. So it was very, very fun to drive. The only thing that was tricky on this was we had German spec vehicles. So they had the ceramic brakes. They were a little grabby. A little too grabby. I wasn't used to it. And they were kind of saying like, in Germany, this is what we all have. We're used to it. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not. So both me and my drive partner, it's like when we first got in, it's like, sorry. As we kept braking too hard. You can make very gently and it grabs. And with the G, what you're getting in this is you have a twin turbo 4-liter V8 engine, 493 horsepower, 486 pound feet of torque, and an 8-speed automatic. There isn't a lot to say other than it moves, it goes, it flies. You want to match the gas on this? Hold on. It's so much fun to drive. And it has a lot of different components that it has incorporated into it to make sure that not only does it have the power to do what it's supposed to do, that it also handles that way, the suspension system and different things that they've done, like all this very technical stuff that everything is named. It's the Porsche this and the Porsche that, a Porsche Active Suspension Management, which is PASM. Like the only place with more acronyms is like the military. Everything has an acronym at Porsche. So it drives, it's something you can drive and you can enjoy it, but it handles well. And what it does is give you that power, but not do it in such an aggressive, harsh way that you would not want to take this on a road trip. Like, it strikes this really good balance. And I think that's what the GTS was supposed to do. If you want to take it to a track, if you want to drive all out on twisty roads in Georgia, you can do that. And it handles beautifully. Like, your passenger, you know, on twisty roads when we're driving, and we drive pretty hard, most of us, I think, when we're testing this stuff out, you can easily make your passenger queasy.
I always just cruise along.
You always just cruise along, except for Sam. I
never drive hard.
And Robbie, right? You don't ever drive hard going around corners in a car like this.
I don't even know what corners are.
You don't even know what you're driving straight lines. You just stay in the highway. So, but
I drive so gently that people never realize that we've changed direction.
Oh, wow. So this one, whether you're driving gently like Sam and Roberto or driving a little more aggressively, it's so centered and it's so stable that you don't get that sort of pushing you to the side thing that tends to make people a little queasy. So it's very, very fun to drive and very easy to drive. It actually is all of 10 millimeters, which is 0.3 inches lower. That's part of what they've done with the GTS, which again helps that little tiny bit, helps it handle that much better, lowers things just about a little bit, makes it a little bit more well-mannered. I drove the coupe. I did not drive the SUV, but it was such a fun vehicle to drive. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thought you could take this. That's what was so brilliant about it. It has all this performance. You can drive so aggressively, but we drove through these winding roads, but also spent some time on the highway. And on the highway, it was just this glorious little cruiser. It was well-mannered enough and comfortable enough that I could see spending hours behind the wheel of this on a road trip, as opposed to some little sporty cars that have sort of the same kind of handling and features that after 10 minutes on a road trip, you have felt every pebble, every bump, every crease, every seam in the road. And after an hour, you think, I want to get out of this thing. I need a break. This never hits that. It's totally comfortable the whole time. So it's kind of, it's just balanced. That's the word I would use to describe it. Balanced, just very, very balanced, so that you feel comfortable, you feel at ease. And it's a stupid amount of fun to drive, but it is also a little on the pricey side. It is, depending on whether Porsche. You get the, it's a Porsche. You are paying for all that. But here's the thing. It feels like, you know, sometimes you get into a car and you think, you look at the price and you think, okay, it's pretty, it's this, it's that, but I'm not paying that much money for a car. I don't feel like you get what you pay for. And this one, the coupe is $129,500. It's not cheap. This is a luxury car, but looking at that $129,500, I sort of sat there and thought, yeah, if I have that kind of money to burn on a luxury car, on a performance car, this feels like it's worth every penny of that. I didn't look at it and think that's a ridiculous price for what you're getting. It's absolutely perfect. So this is going to be one of my favorite cars I think I've driven this year, just because it was such a nicely done. It's pretty, it feels luxurious inside. It doesn't feel over the top. It's comfortable. It has performance. It has comfort. It's the just right version of the V8. I loved it. There you go. Bam. Bam. Except for the grabby brakes.
Well, I've driven the Cayenne with the grabby brakes, and a dog ran out in front of us. It was me and Steve Ewing, and it stopped well short of the dog that ran out in front of us on a back road in Northern California. I was like, well, good job.
Yeah.
All right. So. Are we going to guess on the delivery charge on that one?
Dun, dun, dun.
We didn't break it out. I didn't break out delivery charge. Oh, no. Sorry, the delivery charge.
Secret.
Okay, I didn't have to break that out for what I wrote. You guys let's put guesses, and I'll tell you at some point. 1,200 is Roberto. What do you think it is, Sam?
I'm going to say 995.
Okay.
Because these really expensive cars tend to, these really expensive European cars tend to, because they, rather than hiding the excessive price in the delivery charge, they just put it right up front in the price you pay for the vehicle. And so they don't charge you an exorbitant delivery fee.
Yeah, it's not a secret. It's not like, surprise, $1,500 for your delivery. You're like, wait, what? How has my car cost so much money? Why does it cost $1,500? Wait, but the other car is only $900. Why?
So, I mean, the sticker price on this, you know, it's basically the same as the Buick, just with an extra one on attached to it.
Yes, exactly. An extra one.
And needing one.
That's the only difference between these two. That's it. That's it.
You carry the one to the front of the numbers.
And there you go. You have your Porsche.
But then when you drive, here's the thing. They're all expensive. Yes. All the Porsches. But then when you drive it, you're like, Okay, yeah, I get it.
So
now I understand.
So
you're like, Roberto, okay, yeah.
You would have won, but you were far, far short of what the number actually is. 1995.
Oh, really?
Wow.
1995.
So I still won.
Yeah.
You still won. Yeah.
Okay. You got to add another seat. See, Sam, you should have used your rule. You had a one to the front.
That's right.
It is a Porsche. Okay.
You had a one. They're like, it's going to, I don't know, $2,000. Why? I don't know.
It's kind of like Apple pricing, you know, just think of what should this cost and then add
25%.
Yeah. 25-30% to it.
But then they do last those Apple thing. I mean, I have old iPhones that just keep going. Yeah. I of course my other iPhone. Anyway, why are we talking about phones?
Smartphones have gotten way more expensive over the past decade, and all it takes is one impact on a hard floor to make you wish you had spent a few bucks to put a case on it. Going online without ExpressVPN is like not having a case for your phone, and it only costs a few dollars a month. Nicole, Robbie, and I travel a lot for our work, and we spend a lot of time in hotels, coffee shops, airplanes, and of course, the Delta Sky Club. Connecting to the Wi-Fi in any public places with shared Wi-Fi puts your data at risk because bad actors could be intercepting what you send and using it to steal from you. It only takes some cheap hardware to intercept Wi-Fi data, and even a smart preteen can do it. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per victim selling personal information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops the bad guys by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. ExpressVPN uses state-of-the-art encryption that would take a supercomputer up to a billion years to crack. I have ExpressVPN on all my devices, including a MacBook Pro, Windows laptops and desktops, and Android and iOS phones and laptops, or tablets. When I want to be secure, I just launch the app, click once to connect, and my data is secure. As I said, I travel a lot for my work, and I have to connect to countless public Wi-Fi networks in many countries. I have ExpressVPN on all my connected devices so that whoever else is on the same network can't see any of my data. That's important because I often have to check banks, credit card accounts, and transmit client data that might be sensitive, as well as filing articles on news that might be under embargo. ExpressVPN protects all of it, and I've been paying for my own account for years. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. That's expressvpn.com/wheelbearings, and you can get an extra 4 months for free. expressvpn.com/wheelbearings.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Shop Superstart Premium, Extreme, or Platinum Batteries at O'Reilly Auto Parts and get up to a $15 gift card after rebate. O'Reward members can also get a $5 reward with their battery purchase. For power, performance, and reliability, choose Superstart. Only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, T-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media.
Spiders. Let's get back to spiders. What do spiders have to do with the Ram 1500, Sam?
Maybe they had nothing, something to do with it. You never know.
Nothing that I'm aware of. I had no issues with spiders with the Ram 1500. So the one I had was the the 2025 Ram 1500 Limited, which had the 6'4" box. So it's a crew cab with the 6'4" bed. Which is about a foot longer than most
6 foot
crew cab light duty.
I thought you had 6'4". I'm like, that's not a very big bed.
No, 6'4". Yes. most crew cab light duty pickups, full size pickups, are usually about a 5.5 foot box, and this is almost 6.5 feet. So it's longer box, so you can put more stuff in there, which is great. The one I had was in the Delmonico Red Pearl Coat, which is a really fantastic color. You know, it's not Soul Crystal Red, but it looks really good on this truck. You know, it's sort of a burgundy color.
It's just brown enough that if you get dirty, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. That's absolutely true. And they had the Nightshade package. So it had the black grill, you know, and they made the grill bigger this year, among other things. And, so it's got the black grill and the black wheels and everything. And the Limited comes standard with the new high output Hurricane in six straight six cylinder, turbo, twin turbo engine, which means it puts out 540 horsepower, 521 foot pounds of torque, which is more than any of the non Hellcat V8s that have ever been offered in the Ram 1500. So this thing has plenty of power. Power is not something that is in short supply with this thing. Even though this is a you know, fairly full size truck, it's fairly hefty, but it had plenty of performance. One of the reasons why Stellantis gave for developing this engine and putting it into the Ram, dropping all the Hemi V8s from the at least from the light duty Rams, was to improve fuel efficiency, which it does slightly. Because this one as a pre-production model did not have a Monroney attached to it. So the fuel economy for the Ram 1500 HO four-wheel drive, because four-wheel drive is also standard on the Limited, is 15 miles per gallon city, 21 highway, 17 combined, which is not, you know, nothing to get excited about. You know, if you're looking for something with decent fuel economy, it is not nearly as good as what you would get with an F-150 hybrid. You know, those can easily do over 20. And you know, in a week of driving this thing, what was frankly mostly highway driving, some city, probably about 25% city driving, 75% highway driving. It was nothing to get excited about in terms of fuel economy. So compared to the 2024 model with the 5.7 liter Hemi, and that engine only had about 400 horsepower. So that's more equivalent to the standard Hurricane engine. That one was rated at 19 miles per gallon combined. And this one was 17. I got about 17 and a half over the course of a week of driving.
Overachiever.
Yeah. Well,
75% on the freeway.
So nothing, you know, fuel. If you're interested in best fuel economy, the Ram 1500, probably not, at least right now, you know, not until the Ram Charger shows up, or the Rev, you know, probably not your best choice. On the other hand, you know, if you are looking, you know, personally, of the, you know, the four full-size pickups that are on the market, the F-150, Silverado and Sierra, and the Toyota Tundra, I think this is by far and away the best looking of the bunch. I think it also has by far and away the nicest interior, you know, especially in the Limited. But even on the lower trim levels, the interior of the Rams is really, really nice. It's very comfortable. It's got lots of space to store stuff. Yeah, the materials and the fit and finish were excellent, which is good considering this is not an inexpensive truck. The one that I had the new 14-inch or 14.5-inch screen. There's now the standard screen is now the 12-inch that was optional on the previous 2024 models. That's standard, and now the 14-inch is optional. That's what I had on this Limited. It still has some physical controls. It's a portrait style screen. But it still has some physical controls for things like temperature and fan speed and stuff like that, stacked on buttons and switches stacked on either side of the screen. So still very easy to use. It does have support for Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, wireless, in both cases. It's very, very nice to drive. The Limited comes standard with the air suspension package. It also rides on 22 inch wheels, which are quite large, and probably wouldn't want to be, hitting any curbs with those things or bending them on a Michigan pothole. But overall, the ride quality was excellent. One thing, this was the first Stellantis vehicle that I've had a chance to drive that has their new active drive assist feature, which is their hands-free driving system. And that is equivalent to Ford Blue Cruise, Chevy Super or GM Super Cruise. So on certain divided highways, you can engage it. It's very easy to engage. Basically, one button press on the steering wheel when you're on a highway where it's approved and you're centered in the lane, the icon in the cluster will show a steering wheel with hands off the steering wheel. Unlike Ford, Stellantis does put capacitive sensors in the steering wheel. So when it wants you to grab the steering wheel, it actually knows when your hands are on the steering wheel, unlike Ford, which is just taking a wild guess with the torque sensor. So no false positives or false negatives about hands on or off the steering wheel. One of the things I've complained about with Blue Cruise is the interface, where, usually, especially on the F-150s, they tend to have a predominantly blue theme on the instrument cluster display, and then blue icons of a different shade of blue, which it's not, unless you're looking very carefully, it's very easy to miss when it wants you to put your hands back on the wheel. Not the case with the Ram. You get black background when you're using the active drive assist, nice bright green icons, and there's also light bars on either end of the instrument cluster. So instead of putting a light bar in the steering wheel like GM does, they put them on the ends of the instrument cluster. It's still very visible to you. So when it's in hands-free mode, they're green. When it wants you to take the wheel, they turn red. And it's very, very clear, very little chance for mode confusion with this. And the Limited also has a heads-up display, so you also get that repeated in the HUD. The Ram also has a haptic seat. So when it wants you to take control, it'll buzz the seat, which is also a good thing. As far as the performance of the system, I would rate it kind of roughly equivalent to the Blue Cruise. So not as good as Super Cruise. It's not as good at actually keeping the truck centered in the lane, especially if you're going around curves. It will tend to drift to the outside of the curve a little bit, which for a big, fairly wide truck as this is not necessarily confidence inspiring. And it sometimes will wander a little bit in the lane, even on a straight road. But overall it's not bad, but it's not as good as Super Cruise. It does have lane change on demand. And one of the nice things about the interface, it shows you the steering wheel in the instrument cluster. It shows you the steering wheel. If there's a vehicle in front of you within range, it shows where that vehicle is relative to you. And then it shows, a lot of vehicles will show like the lane markings on there that indicate where you are or where where the lanes are that it's detecting the lanes. And an interesting thing that the Ram system does is if there's an adjacent lane that does not have traffic in it and it's possible to do a lane change, it will show that as a dashed line, like a regular lane marking. If you are, say, for example, if you're in the left-hand lane and you just have the shoulder to your left, it will show that as a solid line. Or if there is a vehicle in the adjacent lane that's not a shoulder, it will change that dashed lane marking to a solid lane marking. So you can, with a quick glance, you can see if there's a dashed lane, then you have the ability to do a lane change on demand just by tapping the turn signal stock. So it's a nice interface that works well. The system is fairly conservative, which is good because this is a big truck. It wants to make sure you have enough room. Whenever it's showing that a lane change is available, you can be fairly confident that there's nobody there that's going to get cut off by you. And it also seemed to detect, even if the lane was available, using the radar sensors, the rear radar sensors, it seems to detect the closing speed. So if there's somebody coming up in the adjacent lane that is moving fairly quickly and might arrive in that space by the time you actually execute a lane change, it will show it as, even though it's open right now, it'll show it as a solid line and won't do an auto lane change until that vehicle is clear. So it was confidence inspiring in that way. So some good stuff there. Next year on the Wagoneer, they will be launching their hands-off and eyes-off system. And presumably at some point that will also come to the high-end Rams as well. That's going to add a LiDAR sensor to the package. But for now, it's using cameras and radar. And it's not a bad system. Not great, but not bad. And the rest of the truck, aside from the fuel economy, which was just so-so, was really nice. It's for a big truck. It was very pleasant, fairly pleasant to drive, comfortable. It had the multifunction tailgate, so you can drop it like a regular tailgate, or it's split 60-40, and you can open them up sideways, barn door style. So if you had something long to stick out one side, you can do that and keep the other side closed. Had the trifold tonneau cover. Everything else in there was good. So if you're looking for a full-size pickup truck, I would absolutely consider the Ram. Although I'm not sure I would necessarily go opt for a Limited, because like all the other trucks that have gotten really stupidly expensive, this one has gotten really stupidly expensive.
It's so crazy. Like that night edition, that's a $4,200 package.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all in, the one I was driving was $87,535. And this isn't even the top trim level. They have the new tungsten trim level, which is even more expensive. So $87,535 for this truck.
$1,400. There, I'm saying my number first really quickly before.
$1,495.
Nicole wins. It's $1,995.
Well, it's a pretty big truck. They got to carry it by hand.
Yeah. Well, it's long, so they can't put as many of them on the transports as they can with a shorter truck,
I guess. Sure.
But I say so. Even though I did complain about the fuel economy being just so, that straight six cylinder engine, that is a really nice engine. It's very smooth. It's very powerful. It's a fantastic engine. So I think, when they start building Chargers, the new Chargers next year with that engine as well, I think most people are probably not going to care that it doesn't have a V8 in it anymore.
Probably not.
Yeah, I don't think people even really notice. If you didn't tell them, they wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Like most people, if you put them in a car and told them it was a V8, they could drive that car to the end of time thinking they owned a V8. Yeah. Most people don't work on cars.
But it sure pulls.
Even
like
people who grew up fixing cars don't work on their cars anymore because they just go now. So they don't know. Yeah. If you gave this to a 55-year-old person and said, hey, it's got a V8, and they had it for 15 years, for 15 years, they said, yeah, it's got a V8 in it. Oh, all right, cool. Next. Never know.
All right, let's move on to some of the news of the week. So did either of you ever get a chance to drive the Lexus LFA?
No.
I did not. No, I did not.
I'm trying to think. No, I didn't.
Back around 2009, Lexus launched the LFA as their last supercar. Had a big V10 engine in it. That revved like mad. They only built 500 LFAs. and then they were gone. And they have not built anything like that since. Well, now next year they're going to be launching something that is Autocar is calling it the LFR. And this is going to be the basis of their new GT3 race car. Right now, Lexus runs a GT3 car based on the RCF. And they've been running that car for 6 or 7 years now. And, you know, the RC, the current generation RC has been around for quite a while, and it's, you know, it's getting a little old. And last or 2 years ago, they showed, Toyota showed off a concept for a next generation GT3 race car. And, then they said, yeah, we're going to build something like that. And it looks, you know, there's been spy photos of it now out testing, and, this, you know, long hood, looks like it's going to be about a 600 horsepower V8, in the LFR. What do you think of this design?
I mean, it looks cool.
It does look good. I'm not going to argue about how it looks. It looks good.
Yeah.
You could land like a helicopter on the hood. So that's
fine. You often need to do that. That's something that could be.
You often have like, oh, where do we park our helicopter? Oh, hold on.
Right on the hood of the car. This is not a problem for us.
Yeah. Bang. So this thing ain't going to be cheap. It's probably going to be, you know, probably somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000 and built in very limited volumes. But,
it looks very James Bondy. I feel like James Bond should be driving this. It has a James Bond vibe.
Yeah. You know, the Autocar article, you know, says Lexus to launch Vantage rivaling V8 supercar.
Oh, there you go.
So they're pitching it straight at, you know, at Aston Martin. So,
I actually didn't read the headline. I was just looking at the car. So that's pretty good.
Definitely very James Bondy.
Yeah.
All right. Robbie, in California,
what?
There's a lot of EVs in California. Do you see many BZ4Xs?
Toyota I BZ4X. See a surprising number of BZ4Xs. That's the thing. I'm like, man, people are buying them. I see some Solteras. But I feel like it's a surprising number because it's more than like, you know. But, you know, Toyota people are Toyota people. They're like, I want an EV. I'm a Toyota person, so I'm buying a BZ4X.
Okay. Even though it's kind of, you know, not particularly impressive.
It's just kind of, It's just kind of,
That was such a delicate that was.
It's like we here's our EV and we're like, all right, fine.
You wanted an EV. Here's an EV. Take it.
Yeah.
Leave us alone.
Yeah. We also gave you the GR Corolla. What else do you want from us?
Yeah. Come back in 3 years and we'll do another one.
Yeah. Let's say compared to other vehicles, compared to other EVs. No, I don't see very many. Relative to the rest of the EVs in the world that I see a lot of, I see more VinFast.
You have to take Tesla really? In comparison.
Well, you do have a, so you do have
a there's a VinFast dealer down the street from my house. So,
yeah.
So for however long. And I've actually seen a couple Oceans, but not as many as the BZ4X.
I saw an Ocean just the other day. I was like, oh.
Yeah. So I've seen some Oceans. I see some VinFast. I've seen them all.
Well, apparently there's quite a few of them in New York City now. Matt Hardigree was in a parking garage he's from the Autopian. He was in a parking garage last week and spotted three of them sitting there plugged in and charging. And when he took a closer look, he realized that they all had special license plates that start with a T and end with a C, which is for the Taxi and Limousine Commission. So these were all ride hailing cars. These were Uber and Lyft vehicles that were being charged up. And I guess Toyota is offering some really good lease deals on these things. And so, you know, a lot of Uber drivers have been picking these things up and using them to shuttle people around.
I mean, there's a huge push for the Prius to be in a taxi. So you saw a lot of those. So, you know, you get them in the fleets, get those numbers, and then people see them around. Like, maybe I'll buy the ugly
That's
Prius.
So cool.
And they did.
Yeah.
And if I was hailing a ride, I'd rather be riding around in the backseat of a BZ4X than the backseat of a Prius.
Oh, true. Yeah, totally.
If I had a choice.
I've always wondered how they like pulled that whole Prius thing off. They're like, oh, who's sitting back there? Tiny people, I suppose.
Tiny people. It's those tweens and toddlers again.
Yeah. middle schoolers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You mentioned Fisker. We'll pour out one last one for Fisker, probably.
Yeah.
They finally officially filed for bankruptcy this week. Chapter 11, you know, going to try and reorganize, but, I don't know. Do either of you honestly think anybody would buy the assets of Fisker at this point?
No,
I don't. I mean, they made a cool looking truck, but I mean, so did VinFast. So, I mean, anyone can make a cool looking truck if they try hard enough.
I don't see anyone.
Yeah. The Alaska look cool, but I don't think anyone's going to buy the company just so they can, you know, have it.
I always feel bad when a company goes under, because a company is a company, but behind it, there are people that are doing all sorts of work. There's engineers, designers, and all that stuff. And it's like, that stinks for the people who really have their heart, pour their heart and soul into making that car. But I feel bad for the owners too, because now you're like, the people who bought that, like if you got one of those already, like would they ship something 4,000? It wasn't a lot.
Yeah, it was, I think it was in the US. 5,000.
Yeah. So those people were like hardcore Fisker fans, right? They thought this was cool. They thought it was so cool that they were one of the first people to plunk down money on this, probably before anybody had said anything about how it was going to drive, right? You're that excited about your new car. Now the company's gone bankrupt and there's no one to support your software-defined vehicle.
Yep.
If you can get one for super cheap, you can take that motor and those batteries out and do a resto mod with like pretty much anything. So I'm just throwing that out there. I just keep saying that for people who are like, if you can find a Fisker for like $5,000.
How long do you think it's going to be, Sam? Because you helped me write a story. You gave me great quotes for a story I wrote in CarBuzz before it actually went bankrupt, but it kind of looked like it was going to happen, about what would happen because it's a software-defined vehicle that eventually it could be bricked. How long? We should take a bet. How long do you think before really the people who are driving a Fisker Ocean right now truly face some kind of problem that's like, that's it. You can't drive it. Your car is done.
I think it'll probably be, you know, if the car's working now, and, you know, unless they have some sort of mechanical issue, something physically breaks.
Yeah.
They'll probably be able to go, you know, at least 2 or 3 years and maybe a lot longer.
Yeah. Before you think something software wise goes wonkity and requires.
What'll probably happen is, you know, I mean, there's the software has gotten better, but it's still very buggy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they'll get to a point where they realize this is never going to get fixed.
Yeah.
And it's just getting more and more annoying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, then people will just give up
on it. They're going to get a new phone and it's not going to pair correctly.
And I wouldn't even think about something like that. Yeah. If there's,
Hopefully there's not a security issue that, you know, Fisker didn't see, because that happens. Everyone has security issues. That's how the software world works. And there's no one to update your security. So now if there's, you know, there's some sort of potential for bad actors to do something to these vehicles. I mean, if the car has an in-car modem, maybe turn that off.
Yeah.
If you had a Fisker right now, would you try and dump it? You guys, let's say you guys bought it, you loved it, you bought one. What would you do? You have a Fisker right this minute.
I mean, the resale value at this point is so low that you might as well just keep it.
Hold on to it. Yeah, hold on to it for a few years until it becomes like, you know.
Yeah, perhaps one of the biggest risks, you know, is because it's an EV, you know, unlike a gas vehicle, you know, if you bought a car from a company that made internal combustion vehicles and they went bankrupt, you know, you could still, you know, if you managed to keep everything physically working, you know, for 20, 30 years, you could still pull up to a gas pump and fill the tank with fuel and, you know, drive off. With an EV, one of the things you might see is potentially changes to, you know, some of the software on chargers, and it may get to a point where, oh, this thing will not charge anymore because the software can't talk to the charger.
Especially with NACS, because all the cars have to be updated for NACS for the Tesla J3400, blah, blah, whatever you want to call it. That requires a software update for the cars to plug into that. So I think for that, I think if you're like just level 2 charging, you should be fine, because it's not really
probably
a software handshake. But like for DC fast charging, that's where you're gonna Yeah, there's a potential where at some point it just doesn't want to connect because there might be a bug or there might be a change in the software in the, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, if you can get one for super cheap, you want to drive it around town and then eventually take the batteries and everything out.
No, it's not long for this.
In an El Camino.
Yeah, or you know, you could take the batteries and motors out, put them in old El Camino, and then drop a Chevy small block into the Fisker, just like Bob Lutz did. You know, the first time Fisker went bankrupt, he formed a company with a friend of his called VL Automotive. I think it was VL, yeah, and they were re-engineing Fisker Karmas. And I think they ultimately did about 100 of them and put the powertrain from a Corvette ZR1, a C6 Corvette ZR1, into the Fisker Karma and, replaced the plug-in hybrid powertrain that was in there with a, supercharged V8 and did a few styling tweaks to it. You could do that. You could put in an LS3 small block into a Fisker Karma.
Mm-hmm.
What could go wrong?
It could go wrong. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Speaking of things that they put LS3 small blocks into, Tommy Micah, our friend from TFL, recently did some drag racing with a Miata RF that had a 2017 LS3 small block installed in it. And blew away a brand new Mustang GT with this thing.
It's just kind of funny.
Yeah. And you would think, as small as a Miata is, that, stuffing a V8 in it would actually be really hard. But turns out, it's not easy, but it's not that hard. Because one of the reasons why so many people put Chevy small block V8s into so many cars, so many, non-GM vehicles, is because it's actually a surprisingly small package because it doesn't have overhead cams, so the cylinder heads don't stick out that far. It's not that wide. It's not that long. And it's also, especially the modern ones with aluminum blocks and heads, are not that heavy. Fully dressed, LSV8, with fuel system and ignition system and exhaust and everything, only weighs about 400 pounds, which is not ridiculously heavy. And so you find them, find people putting them into all kinds of stuff like this V8 Miata that they were testing. And like I said, blew away a Mustang GT, and the link to the video will be in the show notes. Because the package is so small, back in the 2000s, GM, Ram, Dodge then, Ford were all planning on putting smaller diesel V8s into their light duty pickups. They already had them in their heavy duty pickups, but they wanted to put them in the light duty trucks. And so Ford had a 4.4 liter diesel V8 that they were developing, and while that was supposed to launch in the F-150 in 2010, they canceled that. It never did, but they did end up using that engine in Range Rovers. The Cummins 5-liter V8 diesel that was supposed to go into the Ram pickups, that ended up getting used by Nissan in the Titan. And GM had a 4.5-liter diesel V8 that they developed. And I actually saw this thing at a GM event in 2009, I think. 2009. They used to do this summer tech event at the Milford Proving Grounds. And it was supposed to launch in 2010. Post-bankruptcy, they ended up canceling this thing. But, they had actually tooled up the factory where they were going to build these things. And they were ready to start production in 2010. They ended up not going forward with it. One of the key elements of this engine was they designed it so that it would fit in the same package envelope as the gas small block. So, you know, at the time, you know, when they first started talking about it, we were thinking, you know, I remember writing a few articles speculating about some of the applications where they could end up using this thing. Basically, it would have fit anywhere where, you know, into any GM vehicle that had a small block V8 in it could have used this engine. And they ended up canceling it. They took all the tooling out of the factory. And for a while, they had it in storage somewhere in the Detroit area. They never went into volume production. They did. They had built, you know, a few hundred of these things for testing and in prototype vehicles. But in the last couple of years, a couple of these have actually started to turn up somewhere, you know, on for sale. I guess it was one on eBay that was listed as non-running, but the drive has an article about it. They found one and they reached out to the person that was selling it. They had two of these prototype engines, and they were looking at, you know, the potential of maybe the writer was looking at the potential of seeing if they could buy them and see if they could get them running. Would have been pretty interesting if they had. It's it would have been a pretty cool project to try and get one of these things going.
Yeah, that'd have been cool.
It goes in the woulda, coulda, shoulda column, right? If they'd pulled it off. Coulda, shoulda. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the articles I wrote back probably around 2007 or so, when they first started talking publicly about this engine, was, you know, to, you know, this thing could have been interesting in a Cadillac to be more competitive with, you know, some of the premium German brands that were doing a lot of, still had a lot of V8 engines at the time. You know, like have this thing in a CTS. You know, this thing would have been pretty powerful. It would have been somewhere around 400 horsepower, I think is the number that they were talking about at the time, 300 or 400 horsepower.
That would have been very cool.
Yeah. But alas, it never came to be.
It never happened.
Yep. Speaking of continuing with engines.
Yes.
Friend of the show, Casey Liss. I don't know if either of you ever listened to the Accidental Tech podcast.
I have not.
Casey and John Siracusa and Marco Arment do this show. And the show originally was spawned out of another podcast. They started off doing a car podcast back in like 2011, of which they only did a dozen episodes, but then they transitioned and started doing ATP, but they still occasionally will do a car segment, usually as part of their after show. You know, where they talk about whatever they're driving or buying or problems they're having with their cars. And on the most recent episode, episode 592, in the after show portion, it starts at an hour and 41 minutes. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes. Casey talks about a little problem that his wife had with their Volvo XC90.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So they've got a 2017 XC90.
Okay.
And it's a T6. So it's the one that has the 2-liter four cylinder with the supercharger and a turbocharger on it. And while Casey, who's also a software developer, was out at the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference in California a couple of weeks ago, getting ready to go into the keynote presentation, and he gets a text message from his wife. Says, "Can I call you?" And so he calls her back, and she says, "The car's dead."
What does that mean, the car is dead? Like, I've never, what do you mean it's dead?
Like, it wouldn't start.
Okay, yeah. That's dead.
Yeah.
Temporarily dead, though. Not like it ran off the edge of a cliff dead.
No. Just, you know, it would not run. And so they had it towed to the local Volvo dealer. And I was chatting with Casey on Slack the other day after I listened to this. And this, what happened to this engine is the craziest thing I have ever heard in my life. I have never heard of such an insane engine failure. I've heard of engines failing in a lot of different ways. This one was completely new to me.
Okay, what happened?
So apparently the serpentine belt that drives the supercharger and the alternator and the AC compressor and a bunch of other stuff had broken. It snapped.
Okay.
Which normally, you know, I mean, that would disable the car, but it would not destroy your engine. And turns out that when they started taking stuff apart, they found on one of the pulleys, so that, you know, when, if you look at modern engines that have these big, wide serpentine belts that wind around all these components to drive all these components, the belts are pretty wide and they're ribbed. And then on the pulleys, there's similar set of ribs, and this helps give extra grip, you know, so they can drive, you know, provide enough grip, you know, so the belts don't slip on the pulleys.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow a very small little pebble got up in there, got jammed in between two of the ribs on the pulley, on one of the pulleys. In turn, as the pulley turned and the belt ran over it, this tiny little pebble started cutting up the pulley, or cutting up the belt, until the belt snapped. Normally, not that big a deal. You right. know, belt's about $100, you know. Right. Maybe
inconvenience to place the belt, you go about your business.
Yeah, you're, you know, your alternator's not going to work and your engine's going to stop. But that wasn't the end of what went wrong. When the belt snapped, it apparently, in the process of spinning around, flew into the cover around the timing belt cover. So, and on this Volvo engine, there's a plastic cover over the timing belt. And the timing belt goes from the crankshaft and drives your camshafts. And as your camshafts turn, they move the valves up and down. And those need to be in sync with the crankshaft. Because if those get out of sync with the crankshaft, then your valves open up when they're not supposed to, like when the piston is at the top of its travel and your valves get bent, and then that's when really bad things happen.
Bad things happen.
And so the serpentine belt apparently shattered the cover on the timing belt, and in turn damaged the timing belt. And so as the engine's running without a timing belt, it bent the valves. And so now, he's looking at somewhere between $14,000 and $20,000
to repair the
engine or replace the engine
because of a teeny tiny little pebble.
A teeny tiny little pebble.
That's horrifying.
Yes,
rocks, man. Why do we even have them?
I don't know. So they should definitely never do.
Is he going to try? Is he going to fix it, or is he like, goodbye, Volvo? Your car, you're done.
Well, as of a couple of days ago, last time I talked to him, they had not made a decision. They were trying to see if they could file a claim with their insurance to see if the insurance would pay for the engine repair. If not,
rock.
I don't know. That's damage to your car, right?
Yeah.
If rock smacked into your car when you were driving and broke your windshield or dented your car. You could file a claim to have it fixed, file a, you know, a glass claim to have the windshield fixed. So I wonder, I mean, it's not something, it's not their negligence, right? A rock just got in there. It can happen.
Yeah.
I'm really curious to see, you listen to this podcast all the time. Sam, I need to know the resolution.
Probably by next week, we'll have an answer on that one. Last I talked to Casey a few days ago, he was still waiting to hear back from the insurance company if they were going to cover this. More than likely, what's going to end up happening is, you know, they will sell the car and buy something else used to replace it.
I wonder if the insurance company would just total it. How much is that car worth?
It's a 2017 XC90. It's probably worth. It's certainly going to be worth more than $20,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes they total cars for weird reasons. You know, it gets close enough.
Yeah. So, we'll see. We'll have to wait and see. But that is a weird engine failure.
Through no fault of anyone's either. Just the vagaries of driving the vehicle.
It happens.
Yeah. That sounds like one of those things, like one of those stories or something like that happens to a race car driver and all their dreams are shattered because one random piece of tarmac flew into the engine just in the right way, you know? Wow, that stinks.
All right. Chinese EVs. This week I visited a company here in Michigan called CareSoft that does, they do engineering consultancy. They do design work for a lot of companies. They also do teardowns and benchmarking on vehicles and vehicle systems. One of the interesting things that they have, one of the interesting capabilities, is they have a CT scanner for a car. And what they can do is they can take a new car, put it in, and it's a very large CT scanner that they developed. They can put the vehicle in there, and they take about 15 million images and stitch them all together and create a complete 3D CAD model of the vehicle without taking anything apart, because, you know, the scanner can go through and, you know, detect the different materials that are in there, different material densities and so on. And, you know, with that many images, it can generate very high resolution imagery and basically have a complete CAD model of the entire vehicle that then they can use that to do all kinds of other stuff. They can use that to do simulated crash testing on the vehicle and aerodynamic testing and all kinds of other stuff. But one of the things that they've got going on right now at their facility in Livonia, Michigan, is they're doing simultaneous teardowns of 6 Chinese EVs. They've got a Zeekr X, Hozon, forget the model name of that one, Netta, I think, or something like that. They have the BYD Seagull, which, you know, sells for as little as $11,500 in China. They had the Leap Motor C10, and Leap Motor is the Chinese company that Stellantis formed a joint venture with last year, and they're going to start selling a couple of Leap Motor models, including the C10, in other markets outside of China. They also had the Xiaopeng G6 and the Avatar 12. But, you know, the C10 I thought was particularly interesting because, you know, this is a car that the Stellantis Leap Motor joint venture is going to sell in places like Europe and Latin America and other countries as well. And this is like a RAV4 CRV size compact crossover. It's electric, has a range of about 275, 280 miles, cost $22,500 in China. And that includes a LiDAR sensor for the ADAS system. You know, so anybody telling you, you know, LiDAR is only for really expensive cars, No, it's getting to be on everything in China. And looking at this thing was really nice. I mean, the interior was really, it did not feel like a 20. Let's put it this way. The interior felt a lot more expensive than the Invista, the Buick Invista.
Oh, no. Don't tell Buick.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Not better than the Invista. That's bad news.
A lot of money. I mean, less, you know,
it is less money, but it's always like, but if it was here, like here, yeah. Would it be less money still once it goes to the 90?
Probably not less than the Invista, but yeah. These things are designed for Chinese crash test standards, which are not as stringent as US standards. You know, it would probably add somewhere around $8,000 to $10,000 to the price. So you're still looking at $32,000 for this thing. You know, for an electric crossover, you know, compact electric crossover, which is right in the heart of the market. You know, the styling on this particular one is not particularly exciting, but frankly, neither is the styling on most cars in this segment. You know, so, if you could get something like this for $30,000 with, you know, 300-ish miles of range, would you be interested?
Yeah, I mean, $30,000.
Yes. I mean, realistically, yeah. I mean,
it's then of course you have to add the tariff to that.
I was going
to
say, as long as the tariff is there, like everyone's in the clear. Yeah. None of these are coming to U.S. with the tariff the way it's structured right now, but the tariff can't last forever.
Yeah. So that's the Leap Motor C10.
Don't tell that to Cuba.
But you know, if you're in Mexico, and you're interested in buying an EV. this might be something you might want to take a look at.
Yeah.
And the Seagull. The Seagull actually is really impressive as well. You know, that thing, you know, starts at $11,500. And yeah, it's all hard plastics inside. But you know, it's certainly no worse than a Chevy Bolt.
It's pretty on par with the Chevy Bolt, and you can get it in Mexico. It's called the Dolphin Mini or the Mini Dolphin. I don't, they did decide not to use the Seagull name because in this part of the world, we're like, ew, seagulls.
Those things. It's like, that's not a thing that you went, oh, I'm driving a seagull. Yeah. No, they're annoying little buggers. I don't want to drive that.
Yeah, it starts at 21 on the beach.
It starts at 21 in Mexico for the, yeah. For the Seagull / mini dolphin or dolphin mini.
So dolphin.
I like that. Dolphin sounds like a much nicer like animal.
The dolphin sounds cute. Like, oh, it's a dolphin. It's cute. It's cute. I'm like, what? No, I don't want to drive one of those.
Call it the pigeon. The pigeon. The sea pigeon.
All right. Road tripping with an EV. We've all done it to varying degrees. And Autopian's got an interesting story about this guy that did a road trip, a 3,600 mile road trip with his Model Y, and added up all the expense he paid, you know, all the money he spent on DC fast charging, the total amount of energy used, and the amount of time he spent DC fast charging. So over the course of this road trip, spent just shy of 11 hours charging the thing. And that didn't include overnight charging at destinations. So that was just, you know, while they're on the road, you know, on this like 2-week road trip.
On the driving parts of things, not the overnight parts of things. Okay.
Yeah. So he spent a grand total of $421.84 on DC fast charging. And at the current U.S. average of, and this obviously does not include California, but the current U.S. average of $31.51 a gallon for gas.
$3.51, not 31.
Yes, $3.51.
What are you guys? You're adding the extra one everywhere now, Sam. Yeah,
sorry, that's just California, $31.
Okay.
The U.S. average of $3.51 a gallon. To do the same trip, you know, for the same amount of money, the car would have to get at least 30 miles per gallon, which, frankly, not that much.
Yeah.
Our Honda Civic.
Not a Ram 1500, I can tell you that.
Yeah, no. But, you know, our Honda Civic, which my wife mostly drives around town, so it's kind of worst case conditions, you know, averages about 32, 33 miles per gallon. And that's not even a hybrid. You know, now they've got the new Civic Hybrid that gets 50 miles per gallon. And, you know, there's lots of other hybrids that get, you know, upwards well over 40 miles per gallon. And they're a lot cheaper. You know, so the point of all this is that, you know, if you're going to get an EV, or actually, I think in general, I think our policies should be less focused on DC fast charging. You know, we need more focus on level two charging, because if you're only going to do DC fast charging, you're actually probably not going to save any money on fuel costs, on energy costs compared to most vehicles. You're going to end up spending the same amount of money. Whereas if you are level two charging, you're going to save a huge amount in fuel costs, energy costs.
That's what most people do. That's the thing, though.
Yeah.
It's like 90% of the time, Alex Gayer probably doesn't go on 3,000, how many miles? 3,600 mile road trips. Yeah. So, you know, on that one thing that he did, it's, you know, oh, it's the equivalent of driving a gas car. Okay, cool. On the other rest of his life.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it shows you that, like,
also, he doesn't have to get his car smogged. Like, I have to get my BRZ smogged right now. That's a pain in my ass.
Oh, is this California thing smogged?
Yeah, we have to smog so our cars don't destroy the environment more so than they already do.
Destroy the environment all we want here, and we don't have to get that. But no, that's the thing with an EV. It's like it's such a hard thing to look at it just truly in terms of am I saving money by buying this? Because there are truly a bazillion factors in it. How you drive, the environment that you drive in, is it cold? Is it, you know, all these different things. I think just buying an EV because you think you're going to save money by buying one is the wrong way to go about it. Like, you just have to kind of want to drive an EV because you want to experience having an electric vehicle. You want the benefit of, okay, so I don't have to buy gas sometimes anymore. You know, I don't like going to a gas station. I'd rather just plug in at home and not look at these sort of the 3,605 mile road trip and use that as my make or break. You know, you got to think about just kind of,
here's an edge case.
Yeah.
Oh, like, these aren't good. I'm like, okay. Like
anything, any vehicle you buy it for the 99% of the time you drive your vehicle the same way, let's say, right? That 1% of the time you do something weird, don't worry about that. Does it work for the 99% of the time you drive your vehicle? That's how it matters. As with any powertrain, whether you're buying a V8 or a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid or an EV, you know?
But I think the bigger issue is, today, most people buying EVs are buying, are new car buyers who represent a small minority of overall drivers and overall vehicle buyers. Sell about 3 times as many used vehicles every year in the U.S. as we do new vehicles. And so with that, if you look at the used vehicle market, if we eventually want to replace most or all internal combustion vehicles with electric, we've got to find solutions for all of those people that buy used vehicles to charge. And a much higher proportion of those vehicles, nearly half of the people who buy used vehicles, live in a circumstance where they don't have dedicated off-street parking. They, live in apartments, townhouses, whatever, or live in neighborhoods where they have to park curbside. And for those people, right now, charging at home is not an option. And so if we really want to make EVs appealing for the mainstream, and used car buyers really are the mainstream, not new car buyers are not the mainstream, used car buyers are the mainstream. If we want to make EVs really appealing and viable for the mainstream, we've got to have much more focus on more affordable charging solutions for those drivers. And DC fast charging, while it's important, and it's a key part of the solution, cannot be the primary part of the solution.
Yeah, we level need, two street yeah. par- charging. I mean, if you go to Europe, you just see that here's a level two charger right here on the side of the road, or right next to, like, in a parking space, or curbside, and it's bring your own cable. So you plug, so you don't have that whole issue where, like, oh, vandals are going to destroy the cables, or the cables are strung about. You're like, no, you just plug your cable in, plug it in your car, and you go home, or you go to work, or you go to the store, or you go do all these other things, because you're like, oh, okay, and then you move on, and it's less expensive than DC fast charging, and you're not, it's something that you're doing while you're doing something else. Which is right. DC fast charging right now, still, especially some of them are in weird spots where you're like, well, I guess I'm just sitting in my car for 20 minutes. This is like, I'm plugging in level two. That's one of the weird things. We got the IONIQ 5 and I was like, oh, I'll probably be doing a road trip pretty soon with it. I was like, oh, am I going to have enough time to go get food?
Well, I mean,
whereas before, like, you plug it in, you're like, oh, we got enough time. Let's go get some food. Let's sit down. And now I'm like, I'm going to plug it in. I'm like, oh, but I better hurry, because if this charge is working correctly, I'm not going to have time to get food.
And Nicole, you did that cross country road trip in an EV.
I did.
And you guys had some pretty sketchy places where you were trying to charge.
That is the thing. I know that that is getting better, and they're trying to make that better. And there was a moment where it was when EVs were, I mean, they're still new. Let's face it. It's not like they're mainstream. They were trying to just put chargers wherever they could put them. This property owner let me put one here. The power grid supports putting it here, put it here. So there was a little bit of that happening. But those haven't been replaced enough by the ones that are in the right spot, in a nice place, in a decent area. So it's like, well, I understand it was when it was new. But now that's still the only charging option here. And I'm in a sketchy hotel in the middle of nowhere that looks like the Chainsaw Massacre could happen here. This is not where I want to be at, 10 o'clock at night by myself for however many minutes it takes, 22 minutes, 23 minutes, whatever juice I need to get.
Like an hour if you're, let's say you're driving a Bolt or a Kona or something, that doesn't charge above, I'm going to sit here for 45 minutes in a corner where they decided, we put some chargers here, but not a light.
Right.
Yeah.
But I I still don't understand. Like, when we have put gas stations everywhere, every gas station you go to is nice. It's covered. It's nice. There's something that it's like, let's just stick there's a charger food out here in the middle of the desert with nothing over it. Or like, there's nothing over. There's no protection. There's no nothing. It is just, it's pouring rain. You get absolutely drenched because in the 2 seconds you have to plug in, there's nothing over your head. And again, I know that they're changing this as it goes on, but still most of them, even the newer ones, like I was at the mall, our local mall yesterday, and I'm realizing the chargers they have are in the farthest back corner of the parking lot, where this, like, the mall was once this robust, huge mall in the 80s, but now no one in their right mind has parked in that corner of the parking lot in 15 years. Like, the grass is growing up through the cracks in the pavement over there. That's where you're going to park if you want to charge your EV. And weirdly enough, across the street, there's a whole bank of Tesla superchargers in this really busy strip mall with a restaurant and all this stuff. And I'm like, that one's there, but the other EV chargers are in the sketchiest location possible. So it's still a challenge to road trip, and the system just doesn't make it easy. Doesn't make it easy.
Yeah. Yeah. We road trip from Berlin to Lake Como in Italy. And where we charge, it was covered. It was next to a McDonald's and a bunch of other restaurants. It was just like, oh, this is nice. Like, you pulled up and everyone just like pulled up. And you had like, there was a cover with solar panels up there. I'm assuming they were. And I went over and I got a McDonald's hamburger, and it turned out being the best McDonald's hamburger I've ever had. Buy McDonald's hamburgers in Germany. They're delicious. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, but
I mean, we are starting to get, some better laid out charging setups. GM is now up to, they've got 46 of the stations that they're putting at, they're doing 500 stations with pilot travel centers. So all these truck stops you see along the highways, they're doing 500 of those with chargers, that are also set up for pull through charging. So if you're towing a trailer, you can pull through. You don't have to mess around with the trailer, and they have covers on them, canopies, just like the gas pumps do. And I think they're at 46 that are either deployed or are in progress. And I think they want to get to the 500, I think, by the end of next year. It's moving in that direction. And others, the Mercedes chargers have covers on them, and EA's got a few. There's some Teslas, I think, that do. That's what we need more of, is having them conveniently located, with other amenities that are going to be useful while you're sitting there waiting for 15 minutes to an hour for your vehicle to charge.
7-Eleven is supposed to start having charging at their places. And the 7-Eleven, the one near my house, they're still not done. It's been like 3 years.
Really? Are they actually still building it, or is it on hold?
It's like built, but first they were like, there was like power issues. Like, they had put it in the wrong spot, so they had to like redo all this stuff. They had to dig up the street. It's a huge mess. It is now June, and it looks like they've been doing work on it, but the last 2 weeks they haven't done anything. And I don't think it's going to be done by the end of the year. It's like a 4 year like weird thing. But the idea, I understand why they put them off in the weird corners, because they're like, there's not going to be enough people to justify putting this where it's going to keep people from coming into our store. I'm like, okay, well, there's other parking spots, okay? But sure, why not? Plus, we gotta dig up the ground in order to put these charging stations, closer to the store. And I'm like, all right, I it's expensive to put those things there. What's the return on investment if you put it a little bit closer to the Denny's?
Just a little closer. I don't need it like – I don't need it right outside the front door, but like, could we not put it so it's almost not even in the parking lot anymore?
Yeah. It's in like another parking lot.
Yeah. That said,
again, I live in the Bay Area, so it's like, EV, but eventually everyone's going to be at the Bay Area, and those charging stations, they're all busy. All the charging stations I go to, I'm like, oh, this one's got someone here. Got to wait a few minutes. Oh, it would sure be nice if I was closer to something. So yeah, eventually these charging stations, they need to, as you replace them, I just feel like if I had a taco truck, I'd just be hanging out at charging stations all day.
Taco truck. Is that going to be your side?
I found an EVgo/Tesla charging location. That's like 20 minutes from my house, but there's a pizza place. They have pizza slices. You get pizza by the slice. And I actually asked the owner, I'm like, so is this bet? Oh, he's like, yeah, when we opened this, we didn't think there was going to be charging here. And now people come over and they're like you, and they're like, I guess I'm here. I mean, I might as well get a slice of pizza.
Right? Like,
yeah. Sit outside and you can see your car and you see all the people pulling up, and you're like, oh, all right, I'm just going to charge up. What did I have
at the
time?
That's kind of a brilliant idea. If you have a food truck and it's like a holiday travel time, you should just park by a charging station, like any kind of chargers that are along a busy route. You'll have people coming in. That's a brilliant idea. Everyone should be doing that.
Yeah. Especially the busy chargers where you're like, oh, I don't want to go to a – what if I go to the fast food and get food and I lose – and now the spot's filled?
Well, my local EA station, there's it's right next to a Popeyes, Burger King, and a Taco Bell.
The Popeyes is dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. So be careful, kids.
Yeah.
Louisiana Fest.
On Friday, I went over to Rivian's Tech Center here in Plymouth, Michigan, and we got a deep dive on the updates to the R1, and we also got an up close look at the R2 and the R3, and the R2, wow, it is really roomy. I was shocked at how much backseat room there is in the R2. It's only a 2-row SUV as opposed to a 3-row R1S. I think that one, when that one arrives in 2026. I think that one's going to be really popular with a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Everyone wants the R3, but the R2 is going to be the one that they sell.
Yeah, it's going to be the sweet spot. Yep.
Yeah. We learn more about the R1 updates. Among the things that they changed in there, when they originally launched the quad motor R1s, they used 4 motors sourced from Bosch, and those motors were quite expensive. They were already developing their own in-house motor design, which is what they launched when they launched the dual motor. Now with this update, they've gotten rid of the Bosch motors altogether. And so now they're offering 2, 3, and 4 motor versions of the R1T and R1S, all using their in-house motors. And that the new quad motor is 1,025 horsepower and 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, which is just stupid.
How powerful is it? It's stupid. How fast?
It's stupid fast.
It's stupid
because we get to drive the dual motor, which is a mere 600 horsepower, and that is
only
more than fast enough that for what anybody needs. That's definitely the even that is on the verge of too fast. But one of the things that they changed, in addition to the motors, they changed the entire electrical architecture of this thing. And so previously the R1s had 16 electronic control units around the vehicle. Now they have 5, including one primary one for the infotainment and the chassis controls. And then 3 zone controllers that handle some of the body functions like mirrors and seats and lights and power distribution, and then the battery management system. So they went from 16 computers to 5. And in the process, they also eliminated a lot of wiring. They took 1.6 miles of copper wire out of the R1. Wow. And the display, they had this ball of copper wire that represented what they took out of the car. It weighed 46 pounds. So they took 46 pounds of copper out of this thing. Yeah. Some pretty impressive changes to this thing. Makes it slightly more efficient than it was before. Not a whole lot more. It has a few miles more range. But the big thing for Rivian is it should be significantly reducing their cost. They're not saying how much, but the cost of building the R1 should, I'm guessing, is probably going to go down by at least $10,000.
Which is huge.
Yeah. So they might even get close to break even and maybe even profitable on some of those 1,000 horsepower versions that sell for over $100,000.
Wow.
So the new R1s are available now, and you can get it with 1.6 miles less copper.
1.6 miles. That's crazy.
Yeah.
What if he asked for it? Can I just get the copper? Like, is it a big wad of copper, please?
Is that your, the picture you have, the giant twine-looking ball of, is that all the copper? There's this picture, the giant ball. He has all these photos, giant ball of copper.
1.6 miles of copper wire. If you took that and unraveled the whole thing, it'd be 1.6 miles.
Miles.
Yeah. That's a lot of copper.
It is a lot of copper.
And then last item, I think last week we talked a little bit about the Ford Super Truck that's running at Pikes Peak this weekend.
Yes.
Our buddy Andre from, TFL, he went to Pikes Peak this week and got to spend some time with the lead engineer on that project and and Romain Dumas, who's the driver. And in qualifying yesterday, that truck was like on the qualifying portion, it was like 10 seconds faster than the second fastest vehicle. 1600 horsepower. The aerodynamics on this thing make 6,000 pounds of downforce. It's just bonkers.
It's pushing you down.
Yeah.
Like the man.
So check out the YouTube link in the show notes. Go check that out. Check out that video. It's pretty wild. Some of the things they changed in that thing. Basically there's pretty much nothing carried over from an actual production. It's sort of vaguely shaped like a pickup truck, but even that would be a stretch. This is a sort of pickup truck shaped, electric race car.
Yeah. It's sure. Call it whatever you want.
Yeah. So that's it for this week. Any other stuff you guys want to talk about?
Nothing else for me. Next week I go to Korea, so hopefully I have something interesting to tell you.
Are you going with the Genesis?
I'm going with the Kia folks, because the EV9 won the top award for Women's World Car of the Year, and we are going to go present them with their award at the Busan Auto Show. Am I saying that right? BUSAN, Busan,
I think.
Busan, so we're going to get to do that. Yeah, so it should be an interesting week with Kia. So hopefully some fun Kia stuff to share when I get back.
Maybe they'll let you test drive a prototype EV3.
Ooh, I think that's really, yes, let's hope that. I'm not holding my breath.
I love Korea. All the food in Korea is good. I don't care what they put
it's all
you.
I don't need an explanation. If they're putting the food on, fine.
I love the street food in Seoul. Fantastic street food in Seoul.
Food in Korea is good.
We're arriving in Seoul at like 5 o'clock, and the other folks are like, "Oh, I think I'm just going to go to bed." I'm like, "What's wrong with you people? We're going to go out, do something."
Go to bed at 5 o'clock? That seems like a recipe for disaster.
I know, right? Stay awake.
What you want to do is sleep for about 5 or 6 hours on the plane.
Yeah.
Get up about wake up about 4 hours before you land.
Yeah.
And if you're arriving at 5 o'clock, wake up about four and a half hours before you land, and then stay up till about 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
That night, and then go to bed, and you should be basically on a career schedule at that point.
That was my thought process. I'm like, what's with you?
It worked for me. It worked great for me when I went to Korea last fall.
Yeah. So that's what I'm planning on going up, if staying awake and going out and doing something, even if I get lost.
Live the time zone you are in.
Exactly.
The time zone you're going to.
Yeah.
As soon as you get on the plane, set your watch to that time zone. Like, oh my God, it's 2 a.m. I should go to bed.
I can be asleep by now, zonk. Yeah.
I mean, you're going to be on the plane for probably, about 14 hours from Boston?
15. I think it's 15 when I looked at the little,
Stay up for the first 4 or 5 hours, sleep for about 5-6 hours,
that's
and then get up for four, and then you'll be good.
So that's the plan.
And then eat some delicious food.
And then eat some delicious food, right?
We will live vicariously through your delicious food.
All right. We'll talk to you all next week.
Bye, everyone.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.